Tonight it's my great privilege to introduce our speaker. I remember hearing his voice with the sun in my eyes at about 7:30 on a late afternoon on March 30th, 2013, I think. And it was Stan. And I couldn't see him, but I heard his voice. We were all praying for him to be here. And here he is, Stan.
My name's Stan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Stan.
And I don't mean hot, like, you know, hey. Anyway. Welcome to anybody who's new to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're glad you're here. I always share this. We hope you stick around long enough to hear the message. And that message is hope and how we're recovering from a seeming hopeless state of mind and body. And what I heard was that welcome when I first got here, you know. You know, there was a lot of places I was welcome, you know, and the most two common places I was welcome was in the back of a cop car and a chain up to go back to prison, you know. And so those were, like, you know, common. But when I come in here and you guys are welcoming me, there was something genuine about when you guys were telling me we're glad you're here, you know. And if you are new, man, I just want you to know that we've been praying for you. And if you're probably thinking, like, oh, God, like, yeah, we've been praying for you. Because at the end of every meeting, we pray for those who are still sick and suffering. And hopefully they make it back to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. So I'm grateful to be here. You know, and I didn't have all day to think about what I was going to share. So everything I'm going to share today is off the cuff, you know what I mean. I usually have a canned pitch I always share. But today I'm going to share where I'm at, you know. And something that's been brought to my attention, like, all week is you know, I can't believe the life that I have today, you know. And it's not anything out here, you know, trust me, you know. Just because I get spiritual doesn't mean my teeth are going to grow back or, you know, any other limbs are going to come back. You know, it doesn't happen that way. But everything on the inside and the person I'm becoming today was, what I'm trying to say is everything I have today was not anything I was praying to happen in my life, you know. It was kind of like I got this sponsor, and the best thing he ever gave me was direction. He told me, take this, take that, do this, do that. And I did it. I didn't question, like, hey, what will happen if I do that, you know? He just told me, prayer, action, leave the results to God. And I just kept walking like a robot, you know, prayer, action. And things started happening in my life, and also doors were shutting in my life. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, the ability to accept that rejection, you know? Because the first thing, someone tells me no, or like, hey, we can't hire you, dude. Like, you got a bad record, or, you know, you've been to prison too many times, you know? Something like that would have been like, you know what, I'm out of here. I ain't gonna do anything, you know what I mean? I'm just gonna get loaded. I'm gonna go right back to what I know best, you know? And what I knew best prior to Alcoholics Anonymous was I knew how to sell drugs and I knew how to drink, man. And do drugs, too. That's all I've ever done all my life. Like, I don't know anything different, you know? You put me in a job, I'm going to get uncomfortable, and I'm going to say, you know, the hell with this. I know how to make money fast and right now. Like, I'm not going to wait around for it, you know? But coming in this time, May 30th, 2013, Billy was there, and my life had been barbecued, you know? And I don't mean that kind of sort of, maybe just a little. No, I had nothing left, man. You know, like Felix the Cat, he's got, you know, bags, you know, little tricks in his bag and shit like that. You know, one of them card sharks, they got card up their sleeves. I didn't have nothing. I had no game. You know what I mean? I was burnt. You know, some people know, I was burnt. I didn't have nothing good going on. And I don't know why I didn't drink that day. I don't know why I didn't get loaded that day, because all that stuff was right there at my disposal. But for some reason, all the way up until I got to that meeting at 7:30, and I walked in that room, May 30, 2013, it was a Wednesday night, it was a book study, and I walked in that room, I seen Billy in the parking lot, and I walked in that room, and I seen a gentleman across the room that I knew I was going to ask him to be my sponsor. And the reason why is because he got sober with a group of men that I got sober with in Santa Barbara years before. And when I asked that guy at the end of the meeting, I asked him with tears, I go, would you be my sponsor? And the only thing he came back, his only reply that melted me was, I'd be honored to be your sponsor. And I just kind of like, oh my God, like, you know. This is the best thing ever happened in my life, you know. I had no idea my life would be this way. I just kept doing what he said, you know. So, where I'm going to start off is I'm going to read something. I don't know if anybody knows what this book is. But this is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the program is outlined in the first 164 pages. And it tells me right here in the preface to the first edition. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Right here. So I got to figure out, well, what are they talking about? So I got to go to the preface. And it says, because this book has become the basic text of our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a strong sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has left largely untouched in the course of revisions made for the second, third, and fourth editions. The section called The Doctor's Opinion has been kept intact just as it was originally written in 1939 by the late Dr. William C. Silkworth. So, before I start my story, I'm going to tell you what started it all. And it says right here, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that, while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. So, as I was growing up, you know, I always felt different. You know, and I'm the only child between my mother and my father. So I had half brothers and sisters and on both sides of, you know, the family. And the ones I lived with, you know, I felt different and they made sure I felt different, you know. And so I chose other avenues to try and check out right here. I've always wanted to check out right here. You know, my parents loved me, though. They spoiled the crap out of me, you know. We weren't rich, but I mean, it's kind of like, yeah, go ahead. All right, yeah, yeah. All right, here, you know. They gave me whatever I wanted, you know. And I didn't really cry for much, but I kind of cried for attention, you know. And so I started meeting friends, you know, and my sandbox was everybody. It wasn't just, you know, this race or that. It was like everybody. Was in that sandbox. And so I got along with everybody. And I played the game with everybody. Even little reindeer games with everybody, you know. And it happened when I was about 7 years old. I come home one day. And my parents, it seemed like there was like just tension in the house. And I remember my parents had been going at it for hours, you know. And I come home. And what happened was that they got divorced. And the significance of that, that's not what makes me an alcoholic. But the reason why I share this is because all of a sudden, the friends I started hanging out with, all of my friends were, you know, their parents were divorced, you know. So it was weird. I didn't notice that till later on. But, you know, and so we all kind of had different freedoms and different things that we liked to do. And one thing we did discover was alcohol, you know, and that was early on. I grew up in two different worlds. I grew up on a middle-class side of town, but my playground was the projects, you know. It was, you know, a lot of stuff was going on over there, a little gang-banging, a little shooting, a little stabbing, you know, and all that fun stuff. And forgot to make coffee. Okay. So I'm mixed up. You know, I'm going to school, and so... My friends are kind of like, you know, what's up? Because, you know, I go to school. I'm growing up on this side of town, so all of a sudden I'm wearing different clothing that they're not used to, you know. And so they started looking at me. They're like, why are you dressing like that? And why are you talking like that? And I didn't even know why I was talking like that. I don't even know why I was dressing like that. But, you know, I wanted to be a gang member, you know. My heroes were all the gang members, and I just couldn't stand them guys who wanted to go on the slide and on the swings, and I don't get that, you know. I gotta stand there like a tough guy, you know. And so, you know, I was kind of mixed up as I was growing up, you know. But so what happened was I was 11 years old, and I made a decision. My brother was having some people over one night, and mind you, you know, as I was growing up, okay, let me bring that up a little bit. You know, as I was growing up, my parents, they loved to party. They loved to host big parties, you know, and they have mariachis, they have trios, and they drank, and, you know, they had money to pay for all that. So, man, it was always going on. There was always something going on. We used to take little vacations every summer. We would go to Lake Tahoe. We'd go to Reno. I'd go with my dad. We'd go to Vegas. You know, and on top of that, my dad loved to gamble. So we go to Santa Anita, Hollywood Park, Del Mar. You know, I was always with them. And there was always drinking involved. And I always kind of looked up to that, you know. I always kind of looked up to that. Like, I didn't know what was going on, what they were doing. I kind of had a feeling for it, you know. Every New Year's, they would give me some of their cold duck or whatever kind of champagne they were drinking. And cold duck is nasty. Anyways, and at least when I was a kid, it was. I drank cold duck as I grew up, and actually it was good. Anyways, so, yeah, but, you know, it's like there was a lot of, not too much dysfunction. I was thinking it was family stuff, you know. I wasn't paying attention to the fights that was going on, the disagreements that were going on. I was just looking at the party. You know, everybody's having fun. So I was always kind of curious about what that would be like for me, you know. And so fast forward, when I was 11 years old, my brother was having some people over. They were going to throw a party, and it was like my brother was someone I looked up to, you know, one of my stepbrothers, and I always wanted to hang out with them. You know, they like to go ride bikes, you know, BMX, and steal other people's bikes, and, you know, I wanted to be a part of that, you know. So I'm very mixed up, right? So 11 years old, he's gonna throw a party. He said, hey, why don't you and your friend come over and hang out? And I was like, what? I got invited, you know. So, and they had all these joints that were rolling up and they were smoking, and so I did it all my first, you know, on that day. You know, I smoked a lot of weed and I drank and I freaking blacked out. You know, I don't remember anything, you know. And it was nothing I ever imagined when I'm watching my family, my dad and everybody else drink. It was nothing I imagined that was going to happen. You know, it didn't happen that way. I blacked out and I wake up in the morning. My friend's going, man, you were off the hook last night. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm like, you're doing some stupid ass shit, trying to do a handstand and doing all. I was like, what the hell? I'm like, that don't even sound like me. But so what did I think right after that? It was like, how can I drink without blacking out? And I get to enjoy myself, you know. And so it was a while before I drank, before I smoked weed again. But at the same age as I was 11 years old, I don't know if anybody's noticed, but I got a big head, right? Because I like to think and I like to figure shit out on my own. You know, I'm a great thinker, you know. And you know, my mother went out one night, and I just came home after hanging out with my friends, and I seen her car keys, and I was like, wait. And I was like, Mom. And I'm looking for her, Mom. And she's not here. And I'm like, I got some bright ideas, right? I was like, you know what? I always, and another thing, my father would drink and get drunk, and he would put me on his lap and he would make me drive. He would make me steer because he couldn't see. So I got to close one eye, mijo. You drive. And I'm like, what the hell? And he put me on his lap, you know? Sick, right? That's the kind of family I was. So I had a bright idea, like, you know what? I'm going to take the car. I'm going to go for a little drive. I don't know. And I didn't plan it out. Like I said, I'm a thinker. I'm like a spur-of-the-moment kind of guy. I'm like, let's do this. And I get in the car, and I take off, and I go to the projects. I pick up all my friends, and I'm like, yeah, we're cool, you know. We're driving around, and I'm barely looking over the steering wheel, and all the rest of the guys are all the same age. I'm 11 years old, you know what I mean? And sure enough, we were arguing about whether or not we should go on Broadway and cruise Broadway like all the rest of the cruisers. And right as we're coming up Main Street, woo! And then, man, it was a wrap. Got pulled over. Cop comes up. It's all license registration. And I'm like looking at him like, are you serious? Like, I don't have no damn license or registration. And then he looked again. He's like, oh, my God. He's all calling his friend. Hey, come and check this out. You know, because it's a bunch of little kids. Like, you know what I mean? I think the oldest guy in the car was 14 years old, you know, but he looked like 12. You know, anyways, you know, and I just remember that was like, that was the beginning of the end for me. What happened was my dad beat my ass for the very last time. He said he never hit me again. And that's not to say about my mom. My mom liked that chancla. Anyways, but, you know, and I remember, you know, and that's like the insanity of alcohol or whatever you want to call it. Is my dad, you know, after he beat me really good, then he started laughing. I'm like, oh, man, he's going to hit me again. Like, this dude is off the hook. And he goes, how far did you guys go? How long were you guys driving around? And I was like, what the hell? Like, is this guy really asking me that question right now? Now, I didn't want to tell him because that would have probably been, you know, grounds for another ass whooping. And so I told him and he was laughing. He's like, oh, my God. And so he tells me, when you turn 12, we're going to go to Vegas and you're going to drive. I was like, oh, hell no. And we did. And we did. He kept his word. But he told me after he hit me, he said, I'll never hit you like that again. He's all, I don't ever want to hit you again. He's all, my dad used to beat me all the time. And he's all, I'd ask him for a nickel and he'd beat me up. And so, and my dad kept his word. Like, he never hit me again. But you know what? I kind of took advantage of that, you know? And, so sure enough, I start junior high and I start smoking and I'm drinking and I'm getting in trouble. And that's like the beginning of the end. Is I kept still trying to capture that moment from when I was 11 years old for the first time. I kept trying to drink like a gentleman, you know. I kept trying to handle my liquor. I want to be able to be with the big guys, you know what I mean, the older guys. And I'm hanging out with older guys that like about 2 or 3 times older than me. You know, and I liked hanging out with these guys, and I liked learning. I always kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say nothing. You know, I just kept learning, and my life was just getting worse and worse. But yet, I'm thinking, and here is that man, I have arrived. You know, and Bill's story—that's what he talks about. He kept saying it over and over. You know, he keeps thinking that he's finally arrived to life, and everybody needs to roll out the red carpet for me. You know, I just kept thinking that. You know, and around 13 years old, you know, I made a decision to start going on to bigger and better things, you know, the next phase of my development. And I started using hard drugs. And life was not getting easy, man. It was hard to put on the front. Like, I had everything going on, you know, and I didn't. And I share this, at around 15 or 16 years old, if you would have gave me the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and you would have sat down and you would have read it and translated it to me, I would have said, man, I got a problem. But I couldn't. I was completely incapable of being able to notice my actions and the things that I was doing and the decisions I was making, you know, because they weren't good, you know. I became completely antisocial from about 16, no, probably about 15 to about 18 or 19. I didn't have anybody in my life other than the people I was partying with and getting loaded with, you know. I didn't have no interest in women or girls, you know. I didn't have an interest in having relationships with other people. I didn't even have an interest in hanging out with my parents. Like, they would always tell me, come on, we're going out to dinner. We're going to go to this place. We're going to go to that place. We're going to go on vacation. And I'm like, no. No. I'm going to stay here, you know. And I managed to keep going to school and staying plugged in with school, you know. I was going to El Puente. It's a continuation school, and all I had to do was half credit a day, and I was good. But I would just go in there and do the bare minimum and leave, you know. And there was some people that really cared about me. There was a teacher there that really cared about me, and she would always call and check on me. And I'm like, hey, I'm good. What do you know? She's like, no, I know something's wrong, and I think I know what it is. And I just kept lying to that lady, you know. I got to make amends to that lady. A few years back, I was in recovery in 2001, and I kind of went and I dropped off a chicken shit letter, and I like dipped out, you know. First time in recovery, in 2001, and And I kind of dropped it off and I left. And she was like, when she found out, she's like, how do I get a hold of this guy, you know? And then last time I came back in, I went and I had to go try and get my transcripts back from her. And I was like hoping that she wasn't there. And she comes out and she goes, come here. And I was like... And she told me with tears, like, man, I've always worried about you. I've always worried about you. And that was good. It was good. It was a good amends, you know. So right when I turned 18, and the reason why I shared that is because right when I turned 18, I said, fuck school. Fuck you guys. I'm out of here. And I moved out to the Bay Area because the stuff that I was interested in was more accessible when I go down the street. And that's what I was doing. I was just drinking and drugging. And that was the time that my mother, like, her real enabling skills came out, and she bailed me out of the Bay Area because I was just doing bad. And I was only gone not even a whole month, and she was out there coming to pick me up because life was just getting really bad for me out there. And I came back, and then, boom, I had a bright idea. Dun-dun-dun-dun. I was like, you know what? I just need a girlfriend. That's it. Just a girlfriend. I need to stop being antisocial. And so I met my later on, she was my wife. You know, she became my wife. But I met her, and things were bad from the beginning. All bad from the beginning. We're drinking, drugging. First we're drinking. Next thing you know, we're drugging. And everything just went bad. You know, she got pregnant with my first daughter. And I had pushed her away so bad because of my actions. You know, I was such a bully, and I would always bully her and, you know, kind of man, like, not so much manhandle, but just like, you know, stand over her. And I was so wrong the way I treated her. And she left me, and she had every right to leave me, you know. And I realized that after she was gone, and I was trying to commit suicide by just taking as much drugs as I can and drinking as much alcohol as I can. And I didn't know, I wasn't thinking that, yeah, you know, suicidal. I was just thinking like, fucking, I wanna numb out. Like, I don't wanna feel shit. Like, I did so wrong, and she left me, and she had every right to leave me. And then not only did she leave me, but she left me with no clue as where she was at, you know? She kinda left me in Tulare. And I just remember, man, having that feeling of just wanting to die, not wanting to feel no more, not caring about anything or anybody, including myself. And as time went on, she finally called me and told me, hey, your daughter was born on February 14th or 13th. And that was my oldest daughter. And I remember being happy just hearing that news. And then within a few months, she lost her rights to that child. And I ended up getting temporary custody for a while. And so I tried to change my life. I'm like, that's it. I'm done. This is my excuse to stop the madness and stop everything. I love my child. Yes, you know, hold her up to the, you know, to the world, and that's it. And man, I couldn't even hang for like 3 months. And then I was like, I can't do this. I need to go right back. I don't have money. I don't have this. I'm like, dummy, you're getting aid. You're getting all this stuff. But no, I didn't have that fast money like I did when I was selling drugs, because that was my next thing that I really picked up on, was I learned how to sell these drugs. And so I became an entrepreneur. At least I thought I did. And so I went right back to what I knew best. Next thing you know, I'm in trouble. And I ended up going to jail for the very first time in 1995. And I went to jail for a year because my public defender, or actually my lawyer, was trying to get me off on just doing some drug diversion and stuff. But I kept thinking, no, I got a case. Like, dude, whatever, okay. And I'm like, you're gonna fight for me. And he's like, dude, take the deal. And I'm like, fight for me. He ended up giving me a year for a possession. Oh my God, I was such an idiot. I was such an idiot, man. But I'll tell you what, man, like I've always been curious about God and having a higher power. And you know, I tried reading the Bible on methamphetamines a couple times, and on acid a few times, and mushrooms once, and I never quite got the gist of what that was all about. But I ended up going to jail, and I found God. Hey, and today my belief right now is every time I've gotten put in an institution, whether it be jail, or whether it be prison, or whether it be a residential program. To me, I'm a firm believer that that's God, in my understanding, putting me in a little time out to really think about who I am, really think about what I want to do with my life. You know, even if I go in the cell for like a couple hours and they let me go, it was always that time that I really thought about my life. But for some reason, every time they told me, okay, roll it up, you're going home, my thinking just goes, squirrel. And I'm thinking about something else. I'm thinking about who's awake, what liquor store is open, you know. I'm not thinking right at all, you know. And I found God, and I heard a message. I heard something while I was in there. There was this guy that brought me closer to God, and I got in touch with him, and he's showing me all this stuff. And then he tells me, he goes home. We're like, yeah, brother, you know, go find a church, get baptized, and praise Jesus and all this stuff. And he takes off, and he comes back in about a month. And this guy used to work out. He was, like, huge, and he came back, like, sucked up. And I'm looking at him, and one of the guys was looking at me, and he seen the way I was looking at him, and he whispered in my ear. He goes, hey, man, it's not the messenger. It's the message. Did you get the message? And I carried that for a long time, you know. So I went on a series of going in and out, having more children. I got to be out the first time ever. You know, the jail let me out. They let me out for 72 hours to see my daughter be born. And that was quite an experience. And I got out, and I wanted to change my life. And I got out, and the biggest mistake I ever made was married her mother. No, I'm just kidding. But it was. No. Because I thought it was a happy family. And we're gonna... No, it didn't work out. We got married and we're arguing at hometown buffet. Oh my God, I can't believe it. An hour later. Anyways. So I went through a rough time. A series of going in and out of jail. They sent me a program. I get out of the program and I couldn't get it right. You know, in 2001, I had in 99, I had another idea because I left that woman. And I was thinking, you know, I just need to be with somebody else. And then I met somebody's mom. I got in trouble, and I ended up getting sentenced to Prop 36 program. And the Prop 36 program barely opened up in July of 2001. And they let me out to do this program. And I stuck around for 14 months, and I did the program, man. I did everything they were asking me. And I got it. I got right in here. You know, how I ended up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous it was an ultimatum. She told me I was in jail, and I'm talking on the phone. And I'm like, no, we're going to go to church, and we're going to do the Bible, and we're going to do this. She goes, I'm going to meetings. And I was like, no. So let me rewind to 1994. They sent me to meetings. I was going to this program, and they sent me to a meeting. And so I walk into this meeting in 94. And back then, man, you could smoke in there, man. I can go like this. I had to go like this just to get through the room. You know, smoking so much. It was at this place called Casa Seca. And I heard these guys sharing, and I knew I had a problem, but I was in so much denial. And these guys were sharing, and I was like, oh my God, I'm in trouble. And so I'm like, I gotta talk to somebody. So right after the meeting, I kind of go and I see them two guys who were sharing, like they were tag teaming or something, you know, and sharing. And I go to rob their conversation. I'm like, hey, so what do you guys do now? You know, I have no idea. This is my first meeting. And them two guys started laughing, and they're like, we're about to go get fucked up right now. And I was like, oh my God. I'm like, come on, let's go. I got the sack. You know, anyways. And so we went off. So here she is telling me, if you go with me to one meeting and you don't like it, then we'll just go to church and we'll do whatever you want. But I mean, I still owe this obligation because I'm in a program. And I was like, all right, I'll go with you to your meeting. Your meeting of what? I don't have no idea. So I went to that meeting and I heard everything I needed to hear at that meeting, you know, and I stuck around. And as a matter of fact, I stuck around more than she did. You know, she was mad because I'm at the alarm club every day from morning to night, opening and closing. Give me a job. Give me a key. And I'm like, man, I was the alarm club guy, you know. And one day some guys who had time, they come up and they're like, man, you're here every day, man. He's all, don't you got kids? And I'm thinking, you know, we help each other out. So I'm thinking they're going to give me a little handout or something. And I was like, yeah. And he's all, why don't you get a fucking job, man? I was like, oh, man. So I went out, got a job, And I become a workaholic and I get loaded. I stop calling them on my commitments. I stop talking to my sponsor and I stop praying. You know? And those are the three dangerous things that you can do. If you're coming and you get into this and you're not doing any of these three things, you're in trouble. You know? So when I hear people talk about what happens to people who don't go to meetings, I know what happens. When I hear when people stop talking to their sponsor, I know what happens. When I hear about people stop going to their commitments, I know what happens. Because I was that guy. You know? So I went out and it was hard to come back. I couldn't come back. I couldn't make it back, man. I tried going to detox and I go into detox and I do it completely wrong, man. I hook up with somebody and it was just bad. It was all bad. And, and at that time I had a little girl, the apple of my eye, you know. She was everything to me, you know. I named her, you know, I felt like, man. And someone burst my bubble, you know. I was talking to this guy I was working with, and I was like, yeah, you know, I just had a baby. Oh, yeah, would you? I go, I named her myself. Her name's Roselia. And he goes, oh, man, I went to school with a girl named Roselia. I go, dude, get the hell out of my face. And I thought I made up that name, right? God. So selfish and self-centered. But anyways, so I'm in and out of the rooms. I can't make it in the rooms. I don't do good at all. And then you know, I'm just out there doing what I do, man. And I graduated, stopped going to county jail. I started going to prison. I'm going to prison. I'm in prison at least two or three times a year. I just keep going in and out. And I don't think about other people, you know. I know every time I get out, I get loaded, I'm going back and I'm okay with that, you know. And have no capacity or care or think about another human being, including my own children. And it was hard, you know. It was hard because I wanted to. I really wanted to. But I couldn't stop getting loaded, man. I couldn't stop drinking. That stuff became priority over everything in my life, you know. And it was hard to admit that because if you would have told me that while I was out there, chances are I'm going to sock you in the face. You know, I'm going to push you in front of a bus or push you off a building. Or, you know what I mean? How dare you tell me about myself, you know. And that's how my life was, you know. My daughter ended up getting, she was diagnosed with leukemia in 2007. And man, I wanted to just stop for that little girl, man. I loved her that much and I just wanted to stop. But I could not stop doing the things I was doing. I'll tell you what though, one of my most honest prayers I ever said was, God, help her before you help me. You know, I couldn't do nothing. I was just so wrapped up in the selling drugs and getting loaded and drinking and running the streets, running from parole, running from everything that's good and decent in my life. I just couldn't stop running, you know. And when the big book talks about selfishness and self-centeredness, man, they're talking about me. They're talking about me. That as much as I want to make things right, man, I'm going to step on the toes of my fellows, you know. And I just keep doing wrong, man. You know, and I just keep making mistakes that I know are going to return and bite me in the ass, you know. And wanting to be there for that little girl was one of them. And I couldn't, you know. I ended up, you know, my parole officer, he would be like, hey, what's up? Are you clean or are you dirty? I'm like, no. I ain't going to tell you yes. I ain't going to tell you no. I'm like, oh, man, he kept sending me this program. And one day he called me in. He goes, man, I need you to come in right now. And I went in packing. I had like 2 ounces of stuff and lots of money. And he just knew. And he asked me, hey, what's up? And I was like, I don't know. He's all right, man. Put your hands behind. And I turned around. And there's like a bunch of parole officers. Like, how the hell did I get in this situation? I thought it was just me and you. No. And I went to jail. And they let me out like that. And I'm like, whoa. And so I go, okay, I'm going right back. And while I was in there, I was thinking, you know what? I need a change. And I go right back out, and boom, I get caught up. And my parole officer kept coming, and he would always come and see me like, hey, Stan, man, they want to lock you up. They want to throw away the key. They want to give you time, man. And I'm like, ah, man, I swear I'm going to stop. I'm going to do it different this time. And he would let me out. So he kept doing that. And this time he goes, you know what? I'm not even going to violate you. I'm not going to send you back to prison. I'm going to let the county deal with you. And they sent me to Santa Barbara Rescue Mission, and that's where I met I met this guy. His name is Andy, and he became my sponsor. And this guy bugged me, man. The first day I went to this meeting, and I went to this meeting, and it's called Men Without Legs, and it's big. There's about 80 men in that room, 80 from 100 men. And I walk in that room, and I'm like, what the hell is going on here? Because I got two guys over here, and they're in the book. I got another guy over here, they're like doing the third step. I got another guy over here who's reading off a little notepad, and I'm like, what the hell is going on in here? And there was a lot of that everywhere. And I remember I was sitting there, I was thinking, no, I gotta get a sponsor. I gotta ask somebody to be a sponsor, because I remember that from when I was in here, 2001. And this guy comes up to me, and he goes, hey man, that's a nice jacket, Holmes. And I was like, oh man, all right, yeah, thanks. And he goes, man, that jacket reminds me of good old Eastside. You know, I was like, what the hell, man? You need to stop, man. I'm trying to think. I got to ask somebody to be my sponsor, but I have my head down. I'm not looking at anybody. So he kept bugging me about this jacket. And I was thinking that, hey, man, I don't fly that way. You know what I mean? It's not that kind of party over here, buddy. And I went to tell him. I was going to tell him he needed to back up. You know, and I look up and I looked right into his eyes. And the thing that I seen in his eyes is what I look for today. I seen peace. And I asked that guy right away to be my sponsor. And he walked me through the book page for page. And he goes, hey, Stan, we're going to start on the blank page, eh? And I was like, blank page? Why does it? He's like, because you come in here not knowing shit, eh? He's like, I want you to write your name and write your sober date. And then we're going to start from there. And we did, man. We got busy. And we started working steps. And I started taking commitments. And I got a good taste of recovery. And then Then my kids were in foster care, and I remember getting to that place, and I was like, I was telling them, I knew they were about to adopt them out, and I remember calling up that social worker, because like I said, man, I was just trying to get them back, man, but I had to be right in order for me to get them, you know? I had to do it for me first before I can do it for them. And I remember calling up that social worker, and I go, look it, I know you guys are going to adopt out the kids, but I want visitation. I want to at least be able to see them so they'll know that I at least tried and I didn't just let them go get taken away and get adopted out. And the lady goes, okay, we'll work with you. And I'm like, all right. So I started the visit process, and I'm going, they were in LA, and I'm going to go visit them. And the next thing you know, 3 months later, she called me up, and I'm like, oh man, I thought it was going to be that call, like, hey, the family's going to adopt them. And what the lady said was like, do you want your kids? And I go, fuck yeah. Like, are you seriously asking me that right now? Well, what do you think? No, I just want them in a, you know. I said, yeah. She goes, okay, we're going to work that out. How much longer do you have in your program? Because you're going to have to get them back sooner. And I was like, man, I got till December. And they're like, well, we'll see, because we're ready to give them back to you in September. And I was like, fuck. And so I did everything they asked me. And I got them back. I got him back, and the first thing this little girl says is, usually it's the mom who does everything. And I understood that. And I did my best, man. And then, so I stuck around for a while, and my daughter goes into remission. She ends up having a relapse of leukemia. And I'm like, man, what do I do? I'm in the middle of recovery. And I did my best to be in that little girl's life as best as I could without pushing my way into her life, you know? And I just kept suiting up and showing up. And every time I told her, hey, I'm going to be there, I was there, you know? Every time I told her, I'm going to come see you, I got something for you, I was there. Because so many times I told that little girl, like, hey, I'm coming over, Daddy's going to pick you up, or Daddy's going to come see you. Okay, I'll be there in a little bit. And I'd be gone, because I'm in my selfish little world, you know. So she got sick, and she had a relapse of leukemia, and then she ended up passing away November 24th. But the trippy thing is, my father passed away August 20th of 2010, and my daughter passed away November 24th of 2010. And I'm a firm believer that my father went first, so that way he can be there in heaven when she came up and she's not alone, you know. And that day, I remember when I got the call, I was at the library, the public library, and I was doing my schoolwork, you know, getting ready for a presentation I had to do. And I got the call, and I remember running to my car, and I turned on the car, and for that split second, I've been going to school long enough that I knew myself that I was either going to lock up and go in crisis mode, or I'm going to give it to God. And the first prayer that came to my heart was, I love you and I trust you no matter what. And I was able to take off and get down to the hospital. Called my sponsor, called everybody that was necessary, you know. And it was hard, you know. But something happened. So that this is what brings me to where I'm at today. What happened was I crossed this invisible line that after she passed away and after the time had passed, I was thinking, yeah, look at me. I lost my father and I lost my daughter and I didn't get fucking loaded. So everything went from right here to right here. I was running on ego. They were asking me to speak everywhere from Santa Barbara to San Luis Obispo. And I'm sharing everywhere. Completely not in tune with what's going on in here. Because I wanted you to see, yeah, look at the tough guy. I can walk through a lot of shit, right? I was carrying a lot of weight, man. I didn't understand that at all. I didn't understand that. Insanity had returned. And it was cunning. It was baffling. And it was powerful. One more time. I had no idea. I had no idea. And what happened was, you know, I got a bright idea that maybe I'm going to try and get in a relationship with somebody. With somebody who's really close to me. And the moment things didn't work out, like they weren't there when I wanted them there, boom, the insanity came back and it came back hard. And I was like, fuck you, fuck them, fuck you. And I had so much anger. I didn't know where it was coming from. You know? And I told my sponsor, I wrote out the inventory. I knew who I was mad at and why I was mad at them. And it had nothing to do with them and it had everything to do with me. And I told him, you know, here's the inventory. I go, dude, I want to get loaded. I want to get loaded bad. And he told me to do a couple things. He told me to go back and do that seven-step prayer, do the seven-step reading, you know, sit down for an hour, seven-step prayer. He's all, and then I want you to go and grab a newcomer or go grab one of your sponsees and just work with them. Just listen to them. And I did everything but that. Because that saved my ass every other time. When my father passed away, when my daughter passed away. And I ended up getting loaded. And I stayed out there. And what I always said was, you know what, I love you and I trust you. I always said that prayer. I always told God, I love you and I trust you no matter what. And I'm struggling. I'm having a hard time out here. I'm dying. I'm drowning. You know, but I love you and I trust you. You know, when I finally made it back, May 30th, 2013, and I got this sponsor. We started working out this inventory. He goes, okay, I want you know what to do. You know how to do the inventory. Let's get it going. I said, all right. First three people on top of that list was my daughter, my father, and God. And I stopped. And I come to realize that I resented God. And it had nothing to do with them. I was mad at them because they left me so soon. I didn't get a chance to say goodbye. I love you. One last kiss. And I was mad at God for doing that. You know? It's easy to see, like, you know, when things are good, right? You know, we see God. And when things are bad, we're like, why, God? You know? And I could not see the insanity of what was going on in my head. Was that I really resented God. Like, who does that? I would have been the last person. If you would have told me you have a resentment towards God, I would be like, bullshit. No, I don't. I love him, man. I could not see it for myself. You know? And so when I got here, this time around, I just stopped trying to do things my way. You know? And I don't do it perfect by far, man. I made mistakes early in recovery, man. I made mistakes. I'm coming to my sponsor. I'm telling him, fuck, dude, I acted out, man. I'm yelling at my kids. I'm pushing my kids. What the fuck, man? I didn't become perfect at all, by far. You know? Early in recovery, and I made mistakes. You know? And I own them today. You know? And just because I work all 12 of these steps does not make me a perfect person. It doesn't. But because I work all 12 of these steps, I can see and own my part. And where I'm wrong. You know? I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's given me a life beyond what I ever imagined it could be. I didn't pray for the things that I have today at all. You know? I didn't pray, God, let me go to school and become a drug and alcohol counselor. God, let me get this car. You know, let me have this. You know, I didn't pray for any of that. I just kept doing the work. I just asked God every day, man, help me stay sober. I have a better chance at living a good and decent life if I stay sober. And you know what? And to tell you the truth, I don't even need drugs or alcohol to go and fuck shit up, man. I don't. I stay in here long enough, I'm going to cause a lot of wreckage, man. I'm going to start doing things without passing anything by anybody else, you know. I got to tell somebody. I got to tell myself on a day-to-day basis, man. Hey, this is what I got. This is what I'm doing. Tell me I'm wrong. I already know I'm wrong. You know? But, yeah, so before I close, I want to read something. I like reading it. It's a good deal, you know. And I found everything I was looking for in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Could you imagine that, you know? I was a Bible thumper, and I was always having Bible studies, and did you know what said this, and did you know what said that? Or I'd be like, yeah, that's you, and you, look at right here, yep, that's you. You know, I like being one of those kind of guys. But what happened was I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I started reading this book, and I'm like, holy shit, like, this is about me. Are you guys, is it Big Brother, or was it camera? Like, fuck, how dare you? You know? And thank God for that. You know, they say the truth will set you free, but first it's going to piss you off. And that's what the Big Book did. It pissed me off. And especially when I had somebody else read it. Because when I read it, it was like, fuck, it's just black and white. Like, there's just words in there. And I had to get a sponsor so we can translate. No, dummy, this is what it says right here. You know, selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our disease. Damn. You know, it started coming to life. So, I don't know. I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful for everything I have and the relationships I have because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the relationships I don't have because of Alcoholics Anonymous and everything I do have and everything I don't have. You know, it's like the more I trust, the more things happen just the way they're supposed to happen. You know, when I get out of the way for a minute, when I back up, like, I don't know what to do right here, God. Like, take over. You know, and when I get in trouble, man, I pray, like, God, this is a sick person, you know, thy will be done. Help me be a better man to that person, you know. And I've made a lot of selfish mistakes and made a lot of selfish decisions, but I get to forgive myself and I get to love myself no matter what, you know. I'm gonna share this and shut up, you know. I shared yesterday at a meeting about a situation that my daughter had been put in, and it had been the first time I ever been in a situation where I don't want to act out. I don't want to freaking hurt nobody. I don't want to do something that's against this right here, these principles. But I love my kids, and I feel so powerless at times, you know. I feel so powerless, but I love them, man. I love them, and I have to say that I love them people who might have did that to them, you know. Because if not, man, I'm going to be in jail. I'm going to be locked up. I'm going to be away from my family because of mistakes that, you know, that I made to go and try and protect my family. You know, the only way I know how to protect my family right now is love them and pray for them on a day-to-day basis. And I learned that here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I didn't learn that from Shopping Cart Willie or Chewy down at Chewy's house. I learned that right here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I've been so misinformed all my life on how I should treat people and how I need to treat myself and what I need to represent as a person and as an individual, you know, going in and out of jail. You know, I was so misinformed for so many years, man, that, you know, coming in here, it's like, I came in here broken. And I'm like, show me what I need to do, you know. My sponsor, I worked the step, he'd be like, what's next? He'd be like, well, just pray till we meet again. You know, simple stuff. Because I just want to do good. You know, I want to stay sober. Whatever is necessary for me to stay sober, you know. And the biggest is not cause any more wreckage in my life, you know. I don't want to feel no more shame. I don't want to feel no more guilt. You know, I don't want to feel anger no more. You know, I just want to love. And I know I can't do that perfect, but I can progressively get better at doing it, you know. So I'm going to keep coming back no matter what. So I'm going to read this real quick. And this is the end of our book. This is page 164. And it says, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we only know a little. We only know a little. God will constantly disclose to you, more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. says the answers will come if your own house is in order. So I got to make sure my house is in order, man. Got to make sure I'm okay. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. You got to have it. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us, and that's a promise. That's a promise. But see to it that my relationship with God is right. You know? And it's a promise. Great events will come to pass for you and countless others. And for me, it doesn't mean like this holy event. Great events is just like what I was talking about. What happened to my daughter? That's a great event. What happened? My mother passing away. It's a great event. Being turned down from a job after I've been there for about almost a year. That's a great event. Those are the things that want to shake our faith and be like, what the fuck, man? It's anything that's going to shake my faith. That's a great event. You know? And it says if I just trust Him and see to it my relationship with Him is right, these events will come to pass. This is what I didn't understand it at first. I'm thinking it's a holy event, a glorious occasion. You know? No, man. It's those things that want to shake me up and make me want to say, F this. I'm out of here. I can't believe your guys' bullshit anymore. You know? It says, this is the great fact for us. So you got over 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind agreeing upon this. Anywhere, anything that's in the first 164 pages, whenever it says we, that's who it's talking about. Them first 100 members that paved the way for us to be here today. From June 10th, 1935, when the first day of Bob's sober, you know, that's a sober day. From that day until this, man. You know, that's been a minute. It's coming up on 80 years. Is it 80 years? 82. It's a long time. Do we have any 82-year-olds? No, okay. Oh. Okay. So here it goes. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you.
All right, let's give Stan another hand. Turn the meeting over to our secretary.